Hello, and welcome to another episode of the Medical Narratives Podcast. I'm Regina Starr, and today we'll delve into the topic of frailty in the elderly. Frailty among the elderly presents a multifaceted challenge to both society and society at large. As a medical condition, it signifies a state of vulnerability, often resulting from age-related declines in physical and mental health. This condition places a significant burden on healthcare systems, increasing hospitalizations and healthcare costs. Moreover, frail individuals may experience reduced quality of life and increased dependence on caregivers. Societally, addressing frailty necessitates reconfiguring healthcare systems to provide better support for older adults and promoting preventative measures through healthier lifestyles. The challenge of frailty underscores the pressing need for a comprehensive, age-sensitive approach to elderly care. To discuss this topic, we sat down with Dr. Michael Gordon, a well-known geriatrician specialist and the host of the Medical Narratives podcast. Hi, Michael.
Hi, good morning.
Good morning. What is frailty and how do you define it in the context of care of the elderly medicine?
Actually, Regina, you just summarized it all, but I will try to go into details. The concept of frailty in medicine, it's not that it's new. It's been recognized for probably centuries, but it's only in the last decade or two that a number of physicians, especially geriatrician Ken Rockwood from Dalhousie, actually focused on it in an academic way and actually developed various approaches and scales to measure it so that it could be used in clinical settings as well as in research settings. I like to go back because you know how interested I am in literature. When Shakespeare wrote, "Frailty, thy name is woman," he wasn't denigrating women, but he was saying something that was interesting, is that when a woman makes a choice, which of course what happened in Hamlet, his mother, a widow, very quickly married another person, he was suggesting that if the woman had been stronger and not frail, she wouldn't have made the choice so quickly. But if you look at the dictionary, when you talk about frailty, it sort of summarizes what you sell. It's weak. It's really, you might say, what's the contrast to frailty? Robustness. A robust person is not frail. A powerful person is not frail. Sylvester Stallone is not frail, right? We all have the idea of a strong and robustness. Although we recognize, not only in medicine, but in general in life, frailty, it's important for those of us who practice medicine to actually construct an approach to those people who we think are at risk for becoming frailer as they age, for those who are already frail, and for those who are on a downward trajectory because of their frailty. So I think what we can look at during this podcast is to define some of the issues and some of the conditions that lead to frailty.
Yes. So can you describe the key clinical features and characteristics that help identify frailty?
Yeah. Okay. So in one's practice, whether in family medicine or geriatrics or in surgery, where you're asked to operate on somebody who you're concerned that they may be, in quotes, too frail for the surgery, or in treatments in which you say, gee, I'm not sure if this medication will be tolerated because of your, in quotes, frailty, we have to look at the various features. So usually the syndrome, because it's a syndrome, it's not a disease, it's a syndrome, includes inabilities in a certain number of areas. So that includes, for example, cognition. People who have cognitive impairment, dementia, various rages, subsets of cognitive impairment often do not have the ability to take the protective steps from developing the other components of frailty. People who have difficulty maintaining nutrition or don't particularly like participating in eating as they did in the past have a risk of developing frailty. And part of that is because if there is inadequate nutrition, especially in terms of certain vitamins, those you might be able to supplement with supplements. But I'm concerned about, for example, protein. One needs protein to maintain muscle mass. muscle mass is necessary for ambulation and walking, for doing almost anything. So an older person who becomes resistant to eating, especially proteins, and you see this a lot, they just go, in quotes, off their food for various reasons. And that's something one has to look at. And sometimes if you can't manage to maintain a protein intake that's adequate to maintain muscle mass, we have to take steps to supplement proteins, such as with food supplements, which many of us use. The other component of frailty is mobility. And we see this very often following an injury, a stroke, fracture, or Parkinson's disease, or various other conditions that decrease mobility. So frailty and mobility are interrelated, because if a person isn't adequately mobile, that means the exercise part of combating frailty is no longer an option. So to say to somebody, oh, I want you to go for a half-hour walk every day to maintain your strength, becomes impossible. Well, you say, I'd like you to get a stationary bicycle and bicycle half an hour a day, becomes impossible. So mobility is not only important to maintaining muscle mass, but mobility has an impact on one's general function. So if a person, for example, has difficulty getting from their bedroom to their washroom and has difficulty stepping over a bathtub without help, or if they do it without help, they have a risk of falling, all these issues become a component of the equation of frailty. Because when we look at frailty, you had mentioned in your introduction, the real challenge is vulnerability. People who are frail become more vulnerable. You might say, vulnerable to what? Well, in the next question, you're going to ask the question, what do frail people, what are their vulnerabilities?
And go ahead. What are the major risk factors that contribute?
Yeah. So if you have frailty, almost everything that can happen to an older person, the risk increases. Say something as simple as an infection. You know, winter's coming. And we know that with winter, viral infections increase. And of course, we encourage everybody to get their vaccinations. So it used to be the yearly influenza vaccination, which has been shown to be very effective in either eliminating the likelihood of getting influenza, or if you get it, having a much milder case. And it's always interesting to hear people who are vaccination naysayers, whether it's childhood vaccination or influenza, to say, and I've heard this many times in my practice and in where I worked, I never get the flu. Now, you may have been lucky that you never got the flu, or you have been lucky that you had the flu, in quotes. I say in quotes because I like to call it influenza, because influenza is what killed more people after the First World War than the First World War itself. So if you are frail and you get an episode, an infection with influenza, the likelihood of having a various case or even death is much greater. And not too many years ago, the mother of a colleague of mine, who I actually saw once in consultation, and she was, I would say, not frail in the sense of limited abilities in many areas, but she was on the brink of. And part of the assessment I did was to look at some of the issues that I thought might be beneficial. Now, as it turned out, for whatever reason, and when I spoke to my colleague, I couldn't get an answer why that particular there, she didn't want to get the influenza vaccine. It was something of the order of, oh, I get it every year. I don't think I need it this year. And I've heard that before. And people don't realize, unlike, let's say, measles vaccine, other vaccines, which may last maybe even a lifetime, although we've now learned that some of them do need a booster in adult years, influenza vaccine must be given every year because the actual virus mutates and changes from year to year. And what the manufacturers do, and it's really quite ingenious, they track the first cases of the new year of influenza because it follows a pattern. And it does often start in Asia for whatever reason. So they identify the virus in the first cases and they tailor the new vaccine based on those viruses. And usually the vaccine has three antibodies in it to kind of cover the waterfront. Every now and then they miss. And one of the viruses that's prevalent isn't covered in influenza. And therefore that year you may have more cases. But they do a pretty good job, especially the large manufacturers, which are in Europe and in the United States. So you need a vaccination each year, usually in the early autumn, because the cases start rising in later autumn, early winter. And it takes about a week or two to develop the immunity. And for the most part, it does the job. This particular person who didn't take the vaccine actually got the influenza and died. And I remember when the colleague said to me, I can't believe it. All she had was the flu. And she developed pneumonia, was hospitalized, and died. So of the things people can do to decrease the risk if they do have problems with frailty is preventative care, preventative steps, influenza vaccine. Now, COVID vaccine is very important. So preventative steps. So of the things that we try to encourage, whatever mobility, disability you have, we try to encourage as much mobility as possible. So for example, if people have problems with their walking, using walking aids really helps. Now, a lot of people say, oh, I don't want to use a cane. Cane is not that helpful as a walking aid. Some people feel most secure with the cane, and it can be useful after, for, let's say, a fracture. But for true stability, a walker is what's needed. And I know that a lot of people say, oh, I don't want to be seen with a walker. Having been ill a few years ago, in which I needed a walker, I can tell you it can be a lifesaver. And it can allow people to become more mobile than otherwise they would be. Diet, I mentioned before, to try to have as robust a diet as possible, as balanced a diet. And if it's not possible, then food supplements might be required. A lot of people get very good at making their own supplements with a blender. You can get anything you want, fruits, vegetables, protein powder, yogurt, and put it in and make it tasty if somebody's not good at actually eating things. Diet's very important. Mobility's very often. Mental stimulation, we have now really accepted, and we learned a lot through COVID, that loneliness and lack of social interaction is a terrible blight. And especially, it's for everybody, everybody. The human species, and I can say from my observation of animals, the animal kingdom, at least the mammalian animal kingdom, and I can say for birds, need others. We thrive on others. So people who become isolated, that's a risk for frailty. And that could be a big challenge. And I know in my own practice, I see people who are homebound. They don't want to go out. And the family tries, the wonderful family tries to get them out, get them to, let's say, a senior center. And I saw somebody recently said, oh, I don't like to go there. I can't. There's nobody to talk to. I said, why? Well, some of them, they're just sitting there. They're not talking. I said, have you gone up to them to introduce yourself? She said, no, I'm not that way. I said, well, you have to. She said, what am I going to talk to them about? I said, it's easy. Go and say, hi, my name is so-and-so. What's yours? I'm a retired. What did you do? Everybody likes to talk about themselves. I know, because in my practice, before I say, how are you? I say, who are you? And people just go on and on. I mean, there's limited time, but I love it because those are my stories, which anybody who's read my articles knows. These are the stories. So social interaction, mobility, diet, mental stimulation. Now, what is mental stimulation? Obviously, most of us who are robust and okay, we get mental stimulation all the time. We read the paper, we watch the television, we solve problems, we go to the store, we make change, we use our ATM, we put in the code, we write. Those are mental stimulation. But we've learned that if possible, actually, it's almost mental exercise is good for the brain. It helps. It kind of stimulates the neurons to do their job. The other one, and that's become more readily recognized, is hearing. A lot of older people, and I know because I have the same problem, have hearing impairment. And I used to say when people said, oh, I can't remember something, I said, well, did you hear it? Because if you didn't hear it, you can't remember it. So that was an easy one. But now we've learned, and a lot of the work is done at the place I used to work at Baycrest, that hearing impairment is a risk factor for cognitive impairment, and cognitive impairment is a risk factor for frailty. So they go together. And I, in my own practice, I've learned when I see somebody, I can tell within 3 minutes whether they have hearing impairment, because as I'm talking to them, they usually turn their head to the good ear towards me or lean forward. And I have in my office what's called the pocket talker, which is really an old-fashioned, it's like the old-fashioned hearing aids, an amplifier. And I put it on them and I turn it up and their eyes light up. I said, can you hear me better? They say, yes. So I speak to the person in the family. I said, look, hearing aids are very useful, but they're not easy to use in a lot of older people. They can't put them in, so you need somebody to put them in for you. They get a lot of background noise, which comes very annoying. So for small situations like sitting around a table talking, a pocket talker does the job. It's cheap. You don't need a prescription. I show them, I just make it easy. I give them a picture. They can take a picture of it, where to buy it. I tell them to get a good set of earphones, because the ones that come with the pocket talker are low quality earphones. For another $25, you can get good non-Bluetooth plug-in earphones. And I've had many, many people, and one of them was my late father, who when I put the pocket talker on here, him, his eyes lit up. So all these things come together. Now, the other thing that's major is medications. And I know that was something you were going to address, so I'll address it. You were going to ask about. Medications are a medical miracle and a medical problem. Many of the conditions that when I was in training were either fatal or caused horrible disability are now a couple of pills away. That's it, a couple of pills a day. So I can remember the introduction of, for example, the diuretic Lasix, right? Furosemide. It was an absolute miracle, because people would die in heart failure, drowning in their own fluids. And now, between intravenous and one or two pills a day, heart failure, part of it could be controlled. I can remember the introduction of anti-Parkinson medication, Sinemet, because I was a resident. I was in Israel at the time. I was a resident, and we had a patient who was completely immobilized, sitting in his chair, staring out, and within 2 days of beginning to get what are now the basis of anti-Parkinson medication, he was up and being involved with a physiotherapist. Michael J. Fox, who's become a real leader in the world of advocacy for Parkinson's, is a perfect example of somebody who has benefited from all the different interventions that have developed. I mean, he's gone as far as getting the newer intracerebral that's into the brain electrodes. And I know somebody personally who's had that for benefit. But in the frail person, even medication that can help can be very, very beneficial. On the other hand, many older people who are frail are on multiple medications. It's not hard in good medicine to be on multiple medications. I always say, if you got heart failure and angina, that's six. If you have blood pressure thrown out, it's another two. There you got eight medications for three common conditions. If you often have also have Parkinson's, that's another one or two. So it's not hard to be, and if you have heartburn, you throw in another. So it's not hard to be on a lot of medications, and each one of them may be absolutely beneficial and useful. On the other hand, as we love to say, on the one hand, on the other hand, you say, why don't we have on the third hand? You say, you could have the third hand also. We have to be very careful about the interaction of medications and their cumulative effects. So that, for example, some medications, which are very useful for one thing, have a negative effect for another. In men, for example, some medications that are beneficial for one thing may have a problem on their prostate, so that was mild prostatic problems become significant, even to the point of obstruction. People who are on antidepressants, for example, often develop very dry mouth. Very dry mouth is a real problem, because if you have a very dry mouth, number one, you have trouble sleeping at night, you keep getting up to drink, and eating becomes a problem. So you have to balance what can you do for the dry mouth. It depends on the antidepressant, and also some of the measures you can take, like biotin, have a very short effect, beneficial effect, and they're not that easy to use. So most of us who look at older people who are frail, one of the first things we do is go through all the medications. And the first question we ask ourselves, what is this medication for? Is it still needed? That's to say, is the condition still there? So for example, you often hear people who are on blood pressure pills, antihypertensive. They say, my blood pressure is fine. Can I stop the pills? Well, the reason the blood pressure is fine, which is the goal, is because they're on the pills. So certain conditions, if you're on it and they work, you have to stay. I've also seen people who, for example, during a hospitalization, I've had many of these in my experience, become very, very agitated. They develop a delirium, especially postoperatively. That's often because they may have some mild cognitive impairment. They get medications and anesthetic, develop the delirium. They're seen by somebody, they're very agitated, and they prescribe what's called the neuroleptic, phenothiazine, which is a heavy-duty sedative. And they calm down and everybody's fine, and they get discharged. And they're discharged on the same medication. And the assumption is, often by the family and the family doctor, that they need to be on that medication. And over my career, I've seen people who've come in, and the family says, you know, since they were admitted to so-and-so hospital with what we thought was a urinary tract infection was treated, they've come out and they no longer interact. They just sit around, they hardly eat, and they indeed are falling into frailty. When I look at the medications and I see they're still on, I'll make up the name, which one, Haldol, quetiapine. There are many. And I say, what was this for? And they say, well, when they were sick in the hospital, they got very agitated, they were put on this. And they say, are they agitated now? They said, no, the opposite. They're completely quiescent. And what I do is I gradually decrease the medication. And guess what happens? They wake up because they didn't really need it other than for short-term care. That's an example of when you go through the medications, the question is, what's it for? Is the condition still there? Is the dose right? Sometimes the dose was right to start with, but now a lower dose will work. Sometimes the medications are interacting with each other, and I've had cases which are the shouldn't happen anymore if you go to the same pharmacy for the medications, duplicates of the same class of medication. In other words, one was prescribed as a generic, one was prescribed as a trade name. Now they'd all be given as generic, but for whatever reason, the family goes to two different pharmacies. And I always say, go to one pharmacy, they have your record, and the pharmacist and part of the program is to look for duplicates and interactions. So medication scrutiny is very, very important in preventing frailty and then addressing it when it occurs. Living conditions, social conditions, all matter. And some of these we can control. I mean, poverty is a risk factor for frailty. Somebody who doesn't have the means to pay for the things that you need for ordinary activities doesn't have a hope to deal with risks for frailty. If you don't have enough money for proper food, you can't be told to have a good diet when you can't afford a good diet. You know, if you read whether it's Canadian or American food guide, they talk about whole wheat grains, whole wheat bread. The last time or the next time you go into a supermarket, grocery store, look at the price difference between the cheapest white bread and the cheapest whole wheat bread. It could be triple or quadruple the price. You can see special deals with 2-for-1s. If you go to Costco, you could see it, of white breads, 4-for-1s, because they're cheap. They are, in quotes, fortified, but they don't have whole grain as the basic flour. And that means a lot for something as simple as bowel movements. Somebody who has chronic constipation is not going to enjoy much of their life, and that's a risk factor for frailty because it has secondary negative effects. So I think all these components go into frailty.
So how can a primary care doctor effectively screen for and assess frailty in their patients during a clinical visit? And are there any specific tools or assessments that a primary care doctor could use to evaluate their patients?
Yeah. Now, there are scores that have been, scales that have been developed. They're often used in research because you want to look at populations. And let's say you're going to try a new medication and you want to look at people and have a frailty score on the baseline and a frailty score at the end to see if there's a benefit. In clinical practice, there may be some short form scores, but the basic principles are there because as your interaction should contain, you're looking at basic things like what's their weight? Has it changed? How's their diet? Is it stable? How's their mobility? Are they bedbound, chairbound, housebound? Are they going out? Are they exercising? What's their medication list like? Are they taking the right medications properly, et cetera, as I mentioned earlier? What's their social situation? Are they being visited? Do they have the ability to communicate with other people? Do they have assistive devices where needed? So I give example, when I was ill and I had trouble with my mobility, I have a long hallway from my sleeping space and the kitchen where I often sit. And I would sort of have to hold onto the wall to walk by. And we knew a carpenter, it was a very fine person, who as his new gig was putting in handrails. And we had handrails put in. Well, these are marvelous. And even when I got better, we didn't take them down because they're very useful. So those things, and sometimes we do a occupational therapy assessment, and if a physician, family physician can request it, to look at the house to see if it's senior friendly, if there are things that put a risk at falls. Falls are devastating for older people. For frail older people, it is often the end. A frail person who falls and breaks a hip, it's almost, it's unlikely they're going to fully recover and they may need long-term care afterwards because of mobility. So we often ask for occupational therapy assessment of the home. They can be done through the community care centers and they look at the safety of the home, the structure of the home, the way the bathroom's working. So for example, something very simple, handrails. Handrails in the shower, the tub, the bathroom, next to the toilet. Somebody who can't get up from the toilet because of frailty and muscle weakness is at high risk of falls. A handrail is very, very effective. And handrails and putting them in is not exorbitantly expensive. I don't know if there are subsidies for that, but I can tell you, having done it on my own nickel, getting the handrails, I got them online. Or if you go to Home Depot, they're there for about the same price. You have to go there. And I found somebody who put them in at a very modest cost. And I know for me, when I was ill, they're a lifesaver. I have them in my in the shower, next to the toilet, and behind the toilet. It's simple things like that should be part of the assessment. Now, whether every family doctor who looks after an older population does this, I can't say. Whether they should, I can say. It should be part of a periodic assessment. In other words, to see whether that person is functioning adequately, and that must include a discussion with a family member who knows what's going on and the encouragement by the family member to the person to not resist. And I've had people say, oh, I don't need handrails. I hold on to the towel rack. Well, if you've ever seen how a towel rack is put in, that's two lugs in the wall and a screw. That won't support anybody. And I always say bathrooms are the most dangerous places in the house because every surface is very hard. You hit your head on the tub, you're finished. So family doctors should have an approach to frailty in the same way they have approach to capacity to see if the person can follow their instructions, take their medications. These are all important components. If not on every visit, periodically as part of the normal for the person who's doing full family medicine practice. And I can see now from some of the referrals that I get to the memory clinic that I work at, physicians who do a marvelous job in this, and the reason, and they send me their notes, the reason that they're referring the person to me is because of the findings that they have and the tests that they are doing periodically. And I can remember when nobody did that. They had somebody, they sent them to somebody else. So I know many, many family doctors, and certainly in the training of current family medicine trainees, it is emphasized in their, especially in their rotations in care of the elderly.
Very good, very good. And do you know of any resources, training, or collaborations that primary care doctors could consider to enhance their ability to manage frailty within
the population? In preparation for this podcast, just to remind myself, because I don't like to go in cold, I looked up Shakespeare. Mm-hmm. I looked up, and there were a number of very good websites, very good articles. I looked them on my phone because that's what I was walking around with. I will send you one that I saw that in the references has another 20.
Okay,
but perfect. The one that I saw was, I can't remember what very reputable medical journal, but it was one that was authored as the, I think the primary author, it's Ken Rockwood, who is the person I mentioned from Dalhousie. So it should be part, in the same way, when you go to the doctor, you expect them at some point or other, or somebody to measure your blood pressure. Somebody who said, my doctor, the nurse has never measured my blood pressure, you say, it's time to say what's going on or find somebody else. That everybody knows that. If a child goes into a doctor who doesn't feel good, that feels well, and the temperature isn't taken, you know, you say, what do you mean the temperature isn't taken? There's certain things you just accept. This is part of medicine. If the doctor doesn't say, hello, how are you? You say, why am I here? So part of the assessment of older people has to include a screening review for frailty. Some of that starts off with, and I have in my new clinic where I'm working, the ability to see the person walk to you. So the way my office is situated in my new clinic, it's about 20 feet from the waiting room. So when the occupational therapist finishes with the mental status exam and they say, is the patient ready? I say, yes. I go out of my door and I say to the patient, I wave to them and I say, come to my office. And I watch them walk. And I can tell you, between watching them walk, sitting down, speaking to them, having them turn their ear to me to listen, and then having to turn to the daughter to get a question answered, I've made 75% of my diagnosis. Frail, hearing impaired, with cognitive impairment. And then I do the other $2,000 testing.
Very good, very good. Well, Michael, thank you. We hope you found this episode informative and inspiring. Join us again on the next episode of Medical Narratives for more medical stories and advancements. If you enjoyed this episode, please hit the applause button and consider subscribing and leaving us a review on your favorite podcast platform. Until next time, take care and stay curious.